waving and yelling their names. Joseph's mother, who is trying to keep track of all five children and keep order, reacts immediately, grabbing his arm and jerking him back to the end of the line where he belongs. "No more trick-or-treating for you tonight," she admonishes. "Since you can't control yourself, you can stand back with me while your brothers and sisters go to the rest of the houses. Maybe that will help you remember to behave yourself next year." Joseph's mother provides a good example of the authoritarian parent. She did not consider Joseph's, or for that matter, any of the children's, age in deciding the costume, and treated all five children as if they were the same age. She was not interested in what Joseph wanted to be for Halloween, finding it easier to make five identical costumes. Her rules are strict and unbending, and when Joseph unwittingly breaks them, the consequence is harsh. We could give Joseph's mom a bit of a pass, considering that she had five young children to keep track of while trick-or-treating. It could be that her authoritarian ways are based on a desperate attempt to manage five small children. It's important to note, though, that whatever the reasons for her behaviors, they will still have the same effect on Joseph. He is learning that having needs and wishes is selfish, and that he's to keep his wishes, needs, and feelings to himself. He's also learning that he is not important. When Joseph enters adolescence, he will be at higher risk of rebellious behavior, and as an adult, he will be very likely to have signs of emotional neglect. Some authoritarian parenting comes in a more subtle package. Renee told me in one of our first therapy sessions, "I was a difficult child. I was always getting into trouble. When I look back, I feel sorry for my parents." When I asked Renee more about this, here's what I learned. Renee's father was somewhat of a stickler, Renee's words. He expected his children to help around the house. He would often come home from work and notice that, for example, the kitchen floor was dirty. "Renee, come and mop this floor," he would yell. If Renee was in the middle of her homework, she would, very reasonably, try to finish writing her sentence or her arithmetic problem before jumping up. This brief delay was interpreted by her father as disobedience. "When I say come mop the floor, I mean now, not 5 minutes from now," he would yell. This was the case no matter what the task and no matter what Renee was doing at the time her father yelled for her. Needless to say, Renee was often in trouble. You might notice that Renee's father did not give her such a strict punishment as some of the other authoritarian parents. He didn't ground her or banish her from Christmas. In fact, what he did would be considered normal by many people's standards. What parent doesn't yell at times? The problem with Renee's dad was that his yelling was loud, and it was mean. It was powered by the feeling that his daughter, by not reacting immediately to his demand, did not love him. He was trying to get his needs met, the need to feel respected and loved, and conveyed to Renee that she'd better do as he says. Unfortunately, what he actually did was convey to her that her needs were not only inconsequential, but also offensive. Renee blamed herself for having unacceptable needs, rather than her father for being unreasonable. She was essentially being sentenced to a lifetime of self-blame and self-directed anger. Fortunately, Renee found her way to therapy, where she was able to learn to accept that it is okay for her to have her own feelings and needs. Zeke rides the school bus home with visions of tomorrow's football game dancing in his head. His father was finally able to get Patriots tickets and is taking Zeke to one of their games for the first time. Zeke has never been more excited. As soon as Zeke arrives home, he hands his mother the note. As she reads it, her face takes on an expression of devastated hurt mixed with anger. "This is unacceptable. You need to learn how to show proper respect. You don't deserve to go to the football game tomorrow. Maybe next time you'll remember to respect Mrs. Rollo. Obviously, Zeke's mother has cracked down hard. She took no time to hear his version of events or to teach him anything about how to manage his emotions or function in a school environment. In place of all that, she's taught him that, as a rule, he doesn't matter. All that matters is respecting authority by following it blindly. Even as Zeke grows up and hopefully gets the message from other people in other situations, a teacher, a friend, his wife, that he does matter, he will still carry a deep-seated tendency to blame himself when things go wrong, and also to be very hard on himself when he makes a mistake. Type 3. The Permissive Parent. The permissive parent could be considered the polar opposite of the authoritarian in many ways. The permissive parent's motto is, "Don't worry, be happy." In our culture, these types of parents are portrayed as beloved and quirky. Think of Dharma's hippie parents on Dharma and Greg, Homer Simpson, Stewie's mother on Family Guy, or Dennis the Menace's pipe-smoking, laid-back dad. The permissive parent could be described as taking the path of least resistance. At best, they just want their children to be happy. At worst, they simply don't want to have to do the work of parenting. Either way, they do not provide their children with limits, structure, or, in adolescence, a strong adult presence against which the child can rebel. Saying no takes energy. Forcing one's child to do a chore or task takes energy. Dealing with an angry child takes energy. Being momentarily hated by your child for saying no is painful. The permissive parent finds it easier to do the chores himself than to make the child do them, and to look the other way or make excuses for the child when he gets into trouble. Permissive parents are often seen as very loving by their children. This is because permissive parents stir up very little conflict with their children. They simply don't say no often enough. Many of these parents have great discomfort with conflict in general and have their own struggles with self-discipline. To help us understand the permissive parenting style, let's look in on Samantha's idyllic childhood. Samantha. Samantha was the envy of the neighborhood. When all the neighbor kids were called in to dinner one by one, Samantha was free to go in last. When Samantha didn't feel like going to school, she was allowed to take a day off by simply requesting it. When Samantha didn't want to go to bed, it wasn't a problem. She was permitted to choose her own bedtime. Samantha's parents believed that children should have complete freedom and that this would help them grow up to be happy adults. And indeed, Samantha was very happy at home. She rarely clashed with her parents, and as she got older, she simply was seldom home. At school, however, there were problems. Everyone knew that Samantha was very bright and capable of making excellent grades. However, her teachers found her to be quite difficult. They described her as spoiled, undisciplined, and underachieving. She had difficulty following rules and was a behavioral problem in class. She tended to miss test days. So, not surprisingly, her grades were well below her potential. You can see how Samantha, as an adult looking back, would feel that her parents were wonderful. "I never felt anything other than fully supported by them," she said in her first therapy session with me 15 years later. By that point, Samantha was working as the manager of a mall clothing store. She was blaming herself for her lack of a college degree. "I had every opportunity," she said. "My parents would have paid for me to go to college, but I threw all that away. I don't understand what's wrong with me." Samantha had no idea that her parents' permissive style had not prepared her for dealing with the requirements of the real world. She was living with a distorted view of her childhood, so had no ability to understand herself or her struggles. Not all permissive parents are remembered with fondness. As an adult, Audrey had a complete lack of relationship with her parents and a lot of anger at herself. Audrey. Audrey turned 13 right at the time that her parents were getting divorced. Her mother was fed up with her father's drinking and cheating and had finally kicked him out. He moved in quickly with another woman, and Audrey was left to live with her mother and younger sister. Audrey's mother immediately met another man, who moved in with them. Audrey's mother was giddily in love and extremely focused on her new relationship. When Audrey realized that neither of her parents was paying attention to her comings and goings, she was thrilled. She began running with a group of older kids, smoking pot and drinking. Audrey's mother realized that she was seldom home, but this was okay with her because it gave her mother more time with her boyfriend. When Audrey was caught at school with pot in her jacket pocket, she told her mother she was just holding it for a friend. Her mother readily accepted this explanation, relieved that her child wasn't using pot. It was much easier to accept Audrey's lame defense than put the effort into investigating, watching, and cracking down on the out-of-control Audrey. By the time she was 18, Audrey had had an abortion, unbeknownst to either of her parents, and had failed numerous high school courses, despite having a high IQ. As an adult looking back, Audrey blamed herself for all of these difficulties. Her parents' near-complete absence in her adolescent years fooled her into thinking that her parents had no influence upon her, either positive or negative. Who, then, could be to blame other than herself? It's hard to see that what's not there can be more important than what is there. She had no idea that between her absent father and preoccupied mother, no one had taken the time and energy to actually parent her. Audrey, as a teen, and also as an adult, was making a mistake in her thinking that many people make. Remember that Audrey was delighted at age 13 that no one was watching and saying no or making rules for her? Samantha also was pleased to have no rules. It's natural for adolescents to crave freedom. They're trying to forge their identities and to separate from their parents. The important thing to keep in mind is that while adolescents crave freedom, it is not healthy for them to get too much of it. Adolescents need a strong parent against whom they can rebel. They learn how to make good decisions and manage their impulses by bumping up against a parent's rules and consequences. Unfortunately for Audrey, she had none of this. Another pitfall of having permissive parents: the child doesn't get enough feedback from her parents. She is left to figure out for herself what she can expect from herself, what she's good at, what her weaknesses are, what she should strive for. To understand this better, let's talk about Eli. Eli came home from fifth grade with his report card. He had 5 C's and 2 D's. His mother opened it, looked at it, and sadly shook her head. "Well, I'm sure you did your best," she said with a sigh. Eli, greatly relieved in the moment, ran outside to play. Despite his relief, though, he had an uneasy feeling running under the surface while he played. "She said I did my best. That means she doesn't think I can do any better." Since Eli's mother didn't require or expect much from him, he grew up not requiring much from himself. His mother's permissive style made it easy for him to do the minimum amount of work, and her permissive feedback gave him a message that his mother may not even have intended. By taking the path of least resistance, she taught him not to expect or demand much from himself because he's not capable of delivering anyway. Zeke handed his mother the note. A barely perceptible shadow crossed her face, but was quickly replaced by a brightening. She picked up a football that Zeke had left on the kitchen counter earlier, pointed toward the living room, and said, "Go long!" Zeke ran to catch the ball. When he caught it, his mom jumped up and down, making cheering noises from the crowd. "You're such a tough guy," she said, while mussing his hair. "Rough day, though, huh? Would some ice cream make it better?" Zeke's mother could easily be interpreted as very loving and caring by anyone who was watching. After all, she wants Zeke to feel better, right? Parents like Zeke's mom are often seen as the cool parent by their children's friends. If Zeke's friends had seen his mother react to problems this way, they'd probably envy him. They'd probably see their own parents as strict and boring in comparison. But even though she may be loving and caring, she has failed her child. She's treating Zeke as a buddy, a pal, not like a child who needs rules to live by and help managing his impulses. A loving, caring parent who is able to do the real work of parenting would not give her child the message that the trouble he had at school isn't important, or that there's nothing to be learned from his mistakes. Zeke's mother traded the opportunity to teach him some valuable lessons for the opportunity to be his pal. The reality is that not all permissive parents are parenting this way out of selfishness, as were Audrey's parents. Many permissive parents, like Zeke's mother, love their children very much and have the best of intentions. Often they are simply parenting their children as they themselves were parented. They don't realize that they must be in the role of authority with their child via limits, consequences, and saying no, in order to help their child know himself and understand relationships and feelings. Type 4. The bereaved parent, divorced or widowed. Bereaved parents are often just desperately trying to cope. It's not easy to have a parent who is grieving. It's even harder when they are grieving your other parent, whom you lost too. Children who lose a parent through divorce or death have their own grieving to do. Grief in a family can be very complicated and difficult. But in this book, we are interested mainly in just one aspect of this situation, when it results in emotional neglect of the child. Sally. Sally is the middle of five children in a loving Irish family. Every day, Sally's family is busy with church activities, Little League, PTA, neighbors, school, cookouts, and piano lessons. The children fight a lot because they're all close in age, but mostly they get along and love each other. Sally's mom is a very busy lady trying to keep up with the children's school and sports while also working part-time at the town recreation department. Sally's mom often tells her friends that she's glad to have her part-time job, as it's the only non-mom-related thing in her life, and without it, she would lose her mind. Sally's dad is an engineer. He makes a good living, and life hurries along with little financial concern. Sally's mother and father have very different temperaments. Her mom tends to be often overwhelmed, distracted, and exhausted with the demands of her children. Her father is not home a lot because he works hard and has a commute, but when he is home, he enjoys his children. As middle children sometimes do, Sally tends to get somewhat overlooked in the family. She's not the oldest or the youngest or the only girl or the most talented, but she has a secret feeling that she is her father's favorite daughter. When they were having their family picture taken, he asked Sally to sit on his lap. Sometimes on Sunday mornings, she gets to sit next to him, and they read the comics together. When Sally was 8 years old, she heard her parents talking in hushed whispers. She tried to listen, but could only make out a few words. One word she did hear was cancer. Sally didn't want to think about that, so she ran off to play. Gradually, over the next few months, she noticed her father losing weight. 6 months later, he stopped working and stayed in bed all day. The day he didn't go to work, the parents had a family meeting and told the children that their father had cancer. "But everything will be okay," they said. "We don't want you kids to worry about this." 3 months later, Sally came home from school, threw her books on the kitchen table, and went to the fridge for a glass of milk. Her older sister came into the room with a tear-streaked face and said, "Daddy's gone! They took him away!" Over the course of the next several months, the full gravity of that statement would hit Sally. She saw her mother very little for the first week after her father disappeared, and when she did see her, her face was still, as if carved from stone. Sally's mother spoke little and did not mention Sally's father or the loss of him. She did not talk directly about it to any of her children. She let the helpful neighbors, aunts, and uncles care for the children, with instructions to try to keep their lives as normal as possible. So Sally was driven to her piano lesson and taken to watch her brother's baseball game. The only day they were held back from school was the day of the funeral. On that day, the children were dressed up, driven to the church for the funeral, and driven home. Still, no one spoke about her father's death. Sally was afraid to say anything to her mother or ask any questions because she had the feeling that any wrong question could make her mother's stone face crumble. Sally didn't want to hurt her mother. After the funeral, life went on. It went on as if nothing at all had happened. No one mentioned Sally's father. It was as if he had never existed. But the family's life changed drastically. Sally's mother had to get a full-time job working in a cafeteria. They sold their house and moved into a much smaller rented apartment with no yard. Sally's mother was gone 9 hours a day at her job. When she was home, she was almost always doing chores, and often with that stone face on. Sally learned to steer clear of her mother, because any needs she had seemed to push her mother close to the edge. Sally lived in fear of seeing her mother fall apart. When I first met Sally at the age of 40, she was single, never married. She was a successful biotech engineer with a house of her own, a dog, and a passion for Sudoku puzzles. But Sally came to therapy because she wasn't happy. "I haven't been happy since I was 8 years old," she said. Although she functioned just fine and had made a place for herself in the world, for 32 years she had struggled with a sadness that she couldn't shake and an empty feeling that she couldn't escape. Sally once told me, "Other people live in a different world from me. They see colors, feel things, love each other, and get excited. I have none of that. To me, the world is gray. I'm on the outside, looking in." Sally was right. She really was living in a gray world. She was running on a half-empty tank of low-octane fuel that had been diluted by a pool of unshed tears. Here are some of the feelings that Sally had been holding inside all those years. Shock over her father's sudden disappearance from her life. Grief over the loss of him. Anger that she hadn't been told that her father was going to die. Fear of talking about anything feeling related because it might hurt another person. This message she had taken from her mom's stone face. Loss of the feeling of being special, as she never again felt like she was anyone's favorite. Fear of becoming attached again, since, from her experience, attachment is disastrously painful. Anger at her family and herself for pretending that her father had never existed after his death. Guilt that she had sometimes wished, periodically throughout her life, that it had been her mother instead of her father who had died. It's important to note here that Sally's mother was a good woman. She worked hard and did her best, despite being overwhelmed. When she learned of her husband's illness and that he was going to die and eventually lost him, she did not have the tools to manage her own grief herself, much less to communicate about it with her children. She went into survival mode and coped with the head-down, nose-to-the-grindstone technique. She did the best she could possibly do with the tools she had available to her. Part of Sally's work was to try to understand why and how it had all unfolded this way, how it had affected her, and all of the intense feelings she had internalized and buried as a result. In our work together, Sally was eventually able to uncover each and every one of those feelings. She spent many hours in my office shedding the tears that she had been holding outside of her awareness all these years. Sally was able, through a lot of hard work, to start to tune into herself, feel alive, and see the world's colors as others do. Zeke comes home from school feeling nervous that he has to show his father the note. He wishes he could hand it to his mother, but this is Thursday, and he always spends Thursday nights with his dad since his parents got divorced. Zeke knows his dad will not take this well, because his dad has been tired, irritable, and short-tempered since Zeke's mom moved out. Zeke doesn't understand why his dad has to be this way. His mom and new stepfather seem really happy, and it pains him to see that his dad is not happy too. Zeke hands his father the note. He watches nervously as his father slowly shakes his head from side to side. "This is your mother's fault," he says. "I'm not surprised that you're starting to get into trouble after all that she's put us through. Don't worry, I'll definitely talk to her about this." You might imagine that Zeke would be confused by his father's reaction. Zeke's own impulses and feisty nature are completely overlooked by his dad, who chooses to see the situation as ammunition to use against his ex-wife, who left him precipitously and remarried quickly. Zeke may be relieved that he's off the hook, but deep down, he feels overlooked. His dad attempts to seem like he's being protective of Zeke, but in reality, he's advancing his own agenda. Sadly, Zeke has no opportunity to learn anything from his mistake. It's certainly understandable for a man to feel angry and hurt when he's suddenly left by his wife. It's also understandable for him to worry that this might damage the child they have together. When Zeke looks back on this scenario from the vantage point of adulthood, he'll remember clearly how his dad was protective and didn't get angry with him for getting in trouble. What Zeke won't remember is what didn't happen. And what didn't happen was all of the things the mother did in my example of emotionally attuned parenting. You may recall that it involves knowing the child's feelings, talking with the child, setting limits, and giving the child a rule to live by. If Zeke's dad continues to ignore his feelings and needs in this way, Zeke will most likely grow up to feel that his dad doesn't really know him as a person at all. But he won't understand the reasons for that because he can't remember what didn't happen. Probably he will blame himself. Type 5. The Addicted Parent. When we hear the word addict, most of us think alcoholic or drug addict. But addiction encompasses a much broader range of compulsive behaviors, from gambling, shopping, and internet or porn addictions, to scratch tickets, cigarettes, slot machines, and online gaming, to name a few. Some of these activities, pursued in moderation, are pleasant stress relievers. But these pursuits can cross the line into addiction when a person begins to feel intense pleasure, bordering on relief when doing the activity or anticipating doing it. Spend more and more time on the activity so that family members notice or complain. Spend money and other resources on the activity, whether or not one can afford it. Use the activity for many purposes, to relieve stress, socialize, play, manage emotions, or entertain others. Deny that the activity is harming oneself or anyone else. In an unprecedented boom of high-tech toys, credit purchases, unlimited web access, and social networking, there's plenty of potential for any of us to develop an addiction. Americans in particular are used to high stress and immediate gratification, both of which feed addictions. Most recently, neuroscientist David Linden wrote about the range of pleasures that our brains may become addicted to. He urges the listener to view addicts compassionately, the way you would any other ill person. But what makes that difficult for family members is the harm that the addict invariably causes the people closest to him. Addicted parents are not all the same. At one end of the spectrum, there is a father or mother who is lost to drugs or alcohol and experiences obvious consequences. Children of these dysfunctional addicted parents are not only emotionally neglected, but traumatized. This is not the parent we're discussing here. We're interested in the functional, loving parent whose addiction may not even be identified as a problem in the family. These are the parents about whom my clients say some variation of, "He had his beers every night, but it wasn't a problem." These are the parents who are forgiven for the wine every night, even if they get irritable or mushy, because they are there for their children in many ways. Functional addicted parents are capable of being good parents. They are there at the football game with the cooler and snacks for the team. They invite over your cousins and aunts and uncles and have barbecues. When you get in trouble at school, they can march into the principal's office and stick up for you. They can make you laugh. So what can a loving soccer mom who likes her wine possibly have done or not done to wind up in this book? Or a hard-working father who likes to bet on every sport on television? Are they guilty of emotionally neglectful parenting? Simply put, what harms children of functional addicted parents is this. They are behaving like two people. And the child cannot always predict which side of her addicted parent is going to show up. When caught up in their addicted behavior, they forget to parent. They are temporarily asleep on the job, and so can be mean, frightening, immature, selfish, or inappropriate. When not caught up in the behavior, the same parent can be kind, supportive, wise, helpful, fun, or reassuring. So for the child of a functionally addicted parent, memories of family life are invariably mixed, with positive memories interspersed with sad ones. After a childhood chock-full of unpredictable parenting, the adult child of the addict is anxious, worried, and secretly insecure. Richard. Richard comes to therapy at age 27 after experiencing a few panic attacks at work. He hadn't known what they were and ended up in the ER twice thinking he was having a heart attack. His father is a highly respected fire chief. When asked, Richard tells me that he had been a star baseball player as a teen. In his junior year of high school, he was even nominated for MVP of the year. Richard also proudly tells me that his father came to every single one of his games. He remembers that his dad often pitched so that he could have batting practice. So far, so good, right? Later in my session with Richard, I ask, "Was there ever a time you can remember growing up when you felt very, very anxious, similar to what you've been experiencing lately?" Here is what he tells me. "It was the awards banquet at the end of the baseball season, junior year. It was at 8 p.m., and I had a little concern because Dad usually had had a few beers by then. When my name wasn't called as the season's MVP and my teammate got it, my dad just stood up and said in his booming fire chief voice, 'That damn kid doesn't deserve it. My son made All-State.' Everyone stopped in shock, looking from me to my dad and back to me again. I was mortified. I just stumbled out of there, went outside, and threw up. I don't like to think about that memory. By the spring of the next season, I was partying too much to play baseball." Children of addicted parents experience the lack of predictability as highly anxiety-provoking. As adults, they are therefore at significantly higher risk to have anxiety disorders and to become addicts themselves than are people who were raised by non-addicted parents. Being a good parent most of the time and a horrible parent once in a while creates insecure, anxious adults who are just waiting for things to go wrong. Another aspect of addicted parenting that amounts to emotional neglect is the addicted parent's tendency to balance his periods of neglect with periods of control and intrusiveness. Elsie is a dark-eyed, insightful 12-year-old brought to therapy by her mother. Her mother, Catherine, is addicted to being thin and also abuses alcohol. She complains to the therapist about Elsie, saying that her grades have gone down and that she has become disrespectful and mopey. She calls Elsie an overly dramatic princess. Elsie's father travels a lot on business, and it is mostly Elsie, her mom, and her younger sister at home. When her mother leaves Elsie and me alone in my office for our first appointment, Elsie tells me that she loves her mother, but that she wouldn't pick someone like her for a friend because she can be mean. She says that the minute she puts her hand on the front doorknob of her house after school, she gets a worried feeling. If her mother hasn't yet poured a glass of wine, things are fine. But if she has, she usually gives Elsie the evil eye when Elsie goes to get a snack, or gets on Elsie to go out and exercise, even though Elsie is thin. Sometimes, says Elsie, it helps to have a mom who watches what she eats. But even though her mom tells her that she isn't fat, Elsie believes that when her mom says, "That crap you're eating is fattening," or "That's enough," or "Go ride your bike, you lazy girl," or "Those pants look tight," she means that Elsie doesn't measure up. When she isn't drinking, however, Elsie's mom would not say anything like that. When parents are caught up in their own addictions, they aren't capable of noticing their child's emotions, nor can they relate to their child as he or she really is. When Elsie's mom, under the influence of alcohol, would tell Elsie, "Go ride your bike, you lazy girl," for example, she was not truly talking about Elsie. She was actually expressing her own feelings about herself, her fear of being fat. When not under the influence, she was able to see Elsie realistically and tell her so. But after a glass of wine, everything was different. This is a perfect example of emotional neglect in action. Elsie is treated as a non-person, simply a reflection of how her mother sees herself. Unfortunately, being a child, Elsie had no idea that this was happening. She took her mother's comments to heart, and by the time I met her, she had low self-esteem and a long-standing feeling of not being good enough. Zeke gets off the school bus feeling anxious. He wonders what he can do to kill some time before he has to go home and give his mother the note from his teacher. He knows that if he can just get home a little later, his mom might be already absorbed in her computer game and not give the note much attention. Zeke's not afraid of his mother's reaction, but he's a bright child and has figured out over time that he can sometimes get away with things when his mom's absorbed with the computer. So Zeke walks around the block, stops by his friend Scott's house, and takes some time looking for cool rocks in the neighbor's driveway. After a while, he realizes if he doesn't get home soon, his mom might get worried, so he gathers up all of his courage and walks in the front door. Zeke notices immediately, with a sigh of relief, that his mother doesn't look up at him when he arrives. "How was school?" she calls to him. "Okay, I brought you a note from my teacher," Zeke replies. Zeke briskly plants the note on his mom's computer desk and runs into the kitchen to look for cookies. He knows his mom won't stop her game to look at it, and by the time she's finished, she may have forgotten it's there. With a sigh of relief at the success of his operation put off getting into trouble as long as possible, he hopes that she wins her games today, so she'll be in a good mood and won't be upset even if she does end up seeing the note. It's important to take note that Zeke is not really worried that his mother will overreact or become angry or abusive. His mother is actually kind, reasonable, and loving. The issue here is that his mother's computer addiction opens a window for him. He has quickly and easily learned how to use that window to avoid things, including the consequences of his own behavior. If he's able to use it on something as serious as a note from his teacher, we can probably safely assume that he's used it in many smaller situations. Zeke has been emotionally neglected here, in that his issue at school may fall between the cracks due to his mother's addiction. If he is successful in his operation, he will not be called to explain himself. He will not get the feeling of being understood. He will not learn how to recognize or put words to his own emotions. In contrast, the things he will learn from his addicted mother are how to avoid consequences and how to play people. Interestingly, as an adult, Zeke will probably not recall this incident of the note from his teacher at all. If he does, it's very likely that he will blame himself for being manipulative, but not his mother for emotionally neglecting him. He'll recall what he himself did, not what his mother didn't do. Type 6. The Depressed Parent. Let's revisit third grader Zeke, who we just left, but he will have a depressed parent this time. Zeke. On his way home on the bus, Zeke feels terrible that he got into trouble at school. He knows that his dad is probably home on the couch where he's spent a lot of time since he lost his job. When Zeke walks through the door, he sees that he was right. His father is lying on the couch with his eyes closed, with ESPN Sports Center providing a lively backdrop. Zeke greets his dad and hands him the note. He adores his father and doesn't understand why he doesn't do anything anymore. His father reads the note, and a look of pain crosses his face. His dad sighs. "Don't do it again, okay, Zeke? That's no way to behave." Zeke is flooded with shame, realizing that it is his poor behavior that makes Dad sad. "I won't, Dad," he mumbles. He stands there for a moment longer, but his dad closes his eyes and appears to go back to his nap. Zeke quietly retreats. If his depressed father doesn't get some help, the outlook for Zeke isn't good. He will grow up feeling that he must be a perfectly behaved child so as not to make his dad feel worse. This pattern may become entrenched in his personality so that he has great difficulty rocking the boat, making mistakes, or allowing himself to be an imperfect human being. The depressed parent has little energy or enthusiasm for the job of parenting. Unlike the narcissistic parent who demands attention, the depressed parent often seems to disappear. He is turned inward, focused on himself and what's wrong with him, worried about whether he's going to make it. He has low energy and little to give. He is missing in action in the lives of his family. And when he is present, he may be irritable or glum. In the face of this, children who are growing up with depressed parents don't know how to get attention from adults in positive ways. Good behavior goes unnoticed, while misbehavior commands at least some attention, however negative it may be. The results of this type of emotional neglect are well documented. In school, children of depressed parents are more likely to be perceived as troublemakers than children of non-depressed parents. Because the depressed parent offers little comfort or encouragement, his child doesn't know how to self-soothe and may turn to drugs or alcohol in adolescence. Because depressed parents appear put upon, beleaguered, or overwhelmed by the ordinary demands of parenting, their children don't always learn that they are worthwhile, and so are at risk to become depressed themselves in adulthood. Finally, because depressed parents have inadequate control over their own behavior, Their children are at risk to be out of control themselves. Margot thinks she's a real badass. At 16, she was kicked out of her public high school for drinking in the girls' bathroom and procuring weed for her softball team. She is being tutored at home. She has told her parents that she has absolutely no intention of stopping partying. When her parents make half-hearted attempts to set limits, she usually walks out the door and goes to a friend's house. Margot tells her friends' mothers all about how awful her own parents are to her, so they are sympathetic to her. Unfortunately, Margot's parents are too apathetic to follow up with other parents, so Margot's description of their alleged atrocities stands. At home, Margot stays in her room and video chats with men on Skype. She shocks her friends by telling them about her daring video sexting episodes. Margot's parents, Elaine and Bruce, are good people. They give to charity, belong to a church, and are kind and respectful to all. But each of Margot's parents is depressed in a different way. They are a little older than her friends' parents, having adopted Margot after years of futile fertility treatments. They have lots of money, thanks to a substantial amount of early Microsoft stock. But Elaine hadn't ever gotten over the 14 years spent trying to become pregnant. Margot frequently finds her mother on the couch when she comes home, sometimes still in pajamas. This enrages Margot, and at such times she is contemptuous and provocative toward her mom. Her dad is not much more involved with Margot. He feels empty and without purpose since he stopped working. He goes to the library and takes courses to pass the time. Margot can remember fun times with him when she was little, but he has become more remote since his wife has gotten more depressed. Often he brings home takeout, since Elaine doesn't cook much, but then he just sits beside Margot's mother in his recliner, watching TV and nodding off. Starting around eighth grade, Margot used to think a lot about how sad and regretful her parents would be at her funeral if she died. Imagining her parents and friends grieving helped in some way when she was sad. These thoughts became so frequent that she started thinking about killing herself for real. When she overdosed and ended up in the ER and then a psych hospital, her parents seemed to wake up and pay attention to her. Lately, they tell her they love her and ask her if she feels safe at bedtime, like the psychologist has told them to do. They are worried about her and question her every time she stays in her room too long. As far as Margot is concerned, finally getting some attention paid to her is great. But Margot is afraid if she gets too happy, they'll stop worrying and go back to being the way they were before. She thinks she sees it happening already. You might be glad to know that Margot's parents did not, in fact, go back to being emotionally distant and depressed. They all got help, and healing for Margot is underway. Not all households with depressed parents are as extreme as Zeke's or Margot's, but when the depressed parents' toxic mix of inattention and distance continues for any length of time, the result is emotional neglect of the developing child. Type 7. The Workaholic Parent. Workaholism is often seen as a positive in our society. The TV show 30 Rock portrays the workaholic quite well in the character of super ambitious businessman Jack Donaghy, played by Alec Baldwin. In one funny scene, lying in his hospital bed after barely surviving a work stress-induced heart attack, he says with great feeling, "Being so close to death has shown me that I've lived my life all wrong." When Tina Fey's character leans in close to better hear the wisdom he's about to impart, he whispers weakly, "I should have worked longer hours and put more into my job." In our capitalist economy, we value hard work and high salaries. Of all the addictions I've mentioned, for example, alcohol, drugs, shopping, or gambling, work is the only one that actually brings money into the household. Workaholics are often driven, successful people who are admired and looked up to by coworkers, family, and community. Unfortunately, it's their children who often suffer in silence. Workaholic parents work long hours, are obsessed by their jobs, and tend to pay inadequate attention to the needs and feelings of their children. To make matters worse, children of workaholics garner little sympathy from others, as they often have successful parents, plenty of money, and nice things. By putting their work first, workaholics convey the message to their children that their feelings and needs are of lesser importance, damaging their children's self-worth. By failing to be an active part of their children's accomplishments and triumphs, they inadvertently convey a message that those accomplishments don't matter, damaging their children's self-esteem. Some children act out in school or with alcohol and drugs to get their parents' attention. Others grow up with inadequate self-worth, low self-esteem, and no understanding of how they got this way. Since they view themselves as privileged, not deprived, they blame themselves for their inner struggles. Low self-worth, low self-esteem, and self-blame quickly add up to depression. Sam. When Sam first came to me for therapy at age 19, he was in his freshman year at a very expensive private college, and he was very depressed. He was failing out of college due to the great difficulty he was experiencing in getting himself out of bed in the morning. He often lost the battle, spending all day sleeping and missing his classes altogether. He was disgusted with himself and expressed it to me this way: "I'm pathetic. My parents have worked so hard to give me a better life than they had, and they've given me every advantage. Here I am, throwing it all away, and I have no excuse for it." In order to understand what was going on with Sam, you must first understand his parents. Sam's parents met in high school and married at age 19. They both came from uneducated, impoverished families. Although both were quite bright, neither had the opportunity to go to college due to their financial situations. From the moment they married, they knew they would have to work very hard to make a decent life for themselves and their children. Sam's father worked his way up from construction worker to managing job sites all over the country. Although this required him to travel frequently, his salary jumped far beyond anything he had ever imagined. In the meantime, Sam's mother started out working the front desk at a chain hotel. She also worked her way up, eventually becoming executive assistant to the CEO of the company, and also commanding a very impressive salary. Unfortunately, part of her job was to jump when the CEO said jump. This meant frequent middle-of-the-night calls, meetings extending well into the late evening, and spur-of-the-moment business travel. The bigger Sam's parents' jobs became, the more excited and invested in them his parents became. They were achieving far beyond their wildest dreams, and it hadn't occurred to them that they could stop, or even cut back. As his parents' jobs grew over the years, Sam gradually lost his parents. Sam, his parents, and everyone else talked frequently about how lucky Sam was, as they kept replacing their houses with bigger ones and buying nicer cars. When he was 9, his parents hired his first nanny. Everyone could see what Sam was gaining materially, but his gradual loss of his parents was invisible to everyone. Between the ages of 9 and 19, Sam went from a child with 2 loving, attentive parents to a college student who was raised by a nanny and was now expected to thrive at college. Everyone knows that if a child's parent dies, the child will suffer with sadness, loss, and possibly depression. No one thinks about this being the case when a child loses a parent to success. Since Sam had no conscious awareness of his loss of his parents, he had no understanding of his sadness and symptoms of depression. He naturally assumed that he had brought it upon himself. That set him up for a lot of self-anger, self-blame, and low self-worth as a teen, and later as an adult. Zeke walked in the door of his beautiful, spacious home and handed the note to his father, who had stopped by to change clothes before going to an evening meeting. His mother was away, traveling for business. His father peered over his reading glasses at Zeke with a disappointed look. "This is not good, Zeke. I'm sorry I have to rush to my meeting right now, but I'm going to give this note to Trish, the nanny, and she'll talk with you about it tonight." You may be wondering what's so bad about this scenario. After all, Zeke has a beautiful home, an obviously caring but busy father, and a nanny who attends to him. But sadly, the reality is that even if the nanny is a wonderful and tuned-in caretaker who says all the right things as she interacts with Zeke, this will still constitute emotional neglect. Because Zeke's dad passes the issue to the nanny, he gives Zeke the message, loud and clear, that his dad's job is more important than Zeke's own life lessons. Later, Zeke will likely remember these things that happened: his father's not unkind reaction, his nanny's talk with him, and perhaps even what he learned from it. He will not realize or remember that his father wasn't able to take time away from his job to talk to him about the note himself, or of the less-than message he received from his father that day. Instead, he'll very possibly be prone to low self-worth. He has the opportunity to process and understand events that happened, but he has no chance to process what he can't remember, what didn't happen. Type 8. The parent with a special needs family member. There is no category of parent who deserves to be in a book about emotional neglect less than the parent in a household where someone is ill or severely impaired. Yet here they are, through no fault of their own, because life has delivered a challenge which is often unmanageable. Listen in on the conversation that parents Tom and Patty are having with their daughter Miranda, age 13, the youngest of three children. "You are such a big help to us, Miranda," says her dad, Tom. "You sure are," adds Patty. "I know it's been especially hard lately with Patrick back at Children's Hospital having his new shunt put in. Your brother Stephen does nothing but complain, but you're my rock." And here is what it sounds like in the Smith household, where 10-year-old Jack's older brother suffers from behavioral and emotional problems associated with autism. "I know it's frustrating that Todd takes your stuff.